thank you very much, Lou. It's a pleasure to see so many of you have turned out on this pleasant evening to hear a professor speaking to you. Lou was saying I'm going to speak for 50 minutes, and that reminded me that I've heard that asking a professor for a short answer is like trying to get a thimbleful of water from a fire hydrant. So I'm aiming for 50 minutes, but whether I will stick to that remains to be seen. Now, if you've been reading any books by the so-called new atheists, or if you've been watching them on TV, you'll know they're pretty scathing of those who disagree with them. And, for example, Richard Dawkins says that those who reject the molecules to man scenario are ignorant, stupid, insane, and he has other more disrespectful names to call them. Now, this evening, I'm going to give you a Christian perspective. So I'm showing you my full qualifications, not to boost my ego, but in case you're tempted to stick one of these labels on me, these disparaging labels on me. I'll just say a little bit about myself, if you don't mind, as well. I was born in England, as you can probably guess from my accent, but I've spent most of my life here in Scotland. My two children were born up here. They're born in Scotland, educated in Scotland. I've kind of adopted Scotland, and I hope the Scots have adopted me. I don't know if they have or not, but I hope they have. I've worked in both Dundee and St Andrews Universities, and I have three degrees, including two doctorates. I have a PhD and a Doctor of Science. I'm a chartered chemist. I've been elected to fellowships of the Royal Society of Chemistry and the Royal Society of Edinburgh, Scotland's premier professional body. And I'm currently working as a research professor of chemistry at St Andrews University. Now, I'm perfectly willing to admit that I'm ignorant about some things, maybe quite a lot of things, but if I'm stupid or insane, then it's a poor lookout for the other 99% of the population in the UK. I much prefer the more modest approach of Nobel Prize winner Richard Feynman. He said, "I believe that a scientist looking at non-scientific problems is just as dumb as the next guy." And I think that is a much more profitable approach to topics like the one that we're addressing this evening. Now, moving to the question of whether God is alive or dead. This idea took hold in the 19th century. It did that as the Newtonian worldview, the so-called Newtonian worldview, came to prominence. And this is the idea that the whole universe is like a giant machine. It has interlocking parts that function by the laws of physics. And as science discovered these laws, it seemed that everything in the universe, material and biological, living as well as unliving, fitted together like clockwork. Soon, everything would be understood, all events and actions would become predictable, and in such a universe, a miracle would be a violation of natural laws. It would be like throwing a spanner into a printing press. There was no room for the supernatural in the Newtonian worldview, and of course, no room for God. So when the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche wrote in 1882, "God is dead, God remains dead, and we have killed him," he was just giving a dramatic voice to the increasingly popular worldview that banished God out of all consideration. Now, I probably don't need to say how important this question is. It has colossal religious and moral and philosophical implications. It's hugely significant for our understanding of the origin of the universe, of the origin and destiny of humankind, and it has a major impact on how we choose to lead our lives. So it's well worth taking a bit of time to think about it and to learn as much as we can about it. Now, the cultural abolition of God and a religion gained a huge impetus over the next half century or so as, in the political arena, Marxism with atheism at its heart, spread across Europe and the world following the Russian Communist Revolution of 1917. In addition, in the behavioural sciences, Freudian psychology became very popular. And this gave scientific trappings to the idea of God as human wish fulfillment. Freud, of course, was a determined and crusading atheist. Then in the scientific arena, probably the most important influence was Darwinian evolution, following the publication in 1859 of Charles Darwin's Origin of Species. Probably this climate of godlessness approached its zenith in the 1960s as communist regimes of one time or another were reaching their fullest extent, and evolution had expanded from biology into behavioural, social, physical science, and from there into historical, linguistic, religious, and other areas. The cultural dominance of this evolutionary paradigm in the West was marked in 1959 by a large and exultant celebration of the centenary of publication of Darwin's Origin of Species at the University of Chicago. Sir Julian Huxley, the renowned evolutionist, gave the keynote address at that occasion, and he said that religion was subject to the laws of evolution, it was fast becoming obsolete, and would soon evolve out of existence. In academic circles, biblical studies took directions that followed the same scientific and ideological developments. Skeptical, highly skeptical, literary analyses emasculated the Old and the New Testaments and relegated them to the status of legend and folklore, largely because miracles were rejected. The New Testament accounts of Jesus were asserted to be unhistorical, and of course, the literal resurrection of Jesus Christ was denied. Under the onslaught of these political, scientific, and theological developments, secular naturalism dominated Western culture, which was characterized as a post-Christian society. I'm sure you've heard that term. Now, this was the culture that I grew up in, and many of you grew up in. Darwin and Freud and skeptical naturalism were the dominant ideas we were taught at school. The most extreme forms of them were promoted by the media and still are to some extent. They're part of our psyche. Remember Freudian slips? Try not to make any this evening. Do you remember the Voyage of the Beagle and the Galapagos Islands? Part of our psyche, are they not? It's hard to change our ideas once we've formed them. They say it's harder to teach an old dog new tricks. According to Dostoevsky, in the second half of our lives, we simply live out the habits that we acquired in the first half. Don't you think that's a pessimistic view of life? We simply live out the habits we acquired in the first half. Now, that reminds me of a story that I once heard. There was this man. He seemed healthy, seemed in perfectly good health, but he had this idea in his head that he was dead. And he used to go around saying, in a zombie-like voice, "I am dead." And they couldn't get much out of him except, "I am dead," in that kind of a voice. Eventually, he was sectioned, as we say nowadays, and sent to a hospital, and they tried group therapy on him. "I am dead." They tried various sorts of drug therapy on him. "No, I am dead." They tried electric shock treatments on him. Seemed perfectly healthy, but they couldn't get much out of him except this, "I am dead." Now, one day, a young, enthusiastic doctor came along to see the patient, and he wasn't quite so politically correct as the other people that had been treating him up to this time. And the doctor breezed in, and he got a bit fed up with this patient, you know, always saying the same, more or less the same thing. So he said to the man, "Do the dead bleed?" And the man said, "No, the dead don't bleed." So the doctor took his scalpel and he gave him a jag on the outside of his hand, and the blood welled out, and the doctor said, "There, look, you bleed, you're not dead." And the man looked at his hand and he looked at the blood and he said, "Well, what do you know? The dead do bleed after all." Once you have an idea in your head, it's difficult to change, no matter what the evidence. Are you open-minded enough to consider alternatives to the views that I've sketched so far? Now, in spite of what I've said, in the second half of the 20th century, a change in public opinion did begin to appear. Under the impact of modern inquiry, the edifice of unbelief began to topple as thinkers started to ask if secular naturalism's clothes were really as fine as their makers claimed. Even the most brutally repressive measures by atheist regimes could no longer disguise the economic and cultural stagnation that their nihilistic ideologies led to. Now, I was going to show you pictures, but the horror of some of the communist suppressive measures were too bad, so I just remind you of the terrible gulag prisons that were originally set up by Lenin for priests, but in which millions eventually perished. Similar appalling repression took place under other atheist-dominated regimes. Remember the Berlin Wall, started building in 1961, but eventually in 1989 it came down amid great rejoicing, and it signalled the fall of communist domination in Europe. In the behavioural sciences, Freud was found to have grossly exaggerated the very limited therapeutic success that he had, and the pseudo-scientific nature of much of his psychiatry became rather widely recognised. A series of new discoveries in the physical and biological sciences also began to reshape the landscape. A remarkable picture of a universe created out of nothing at a definite start date emerged from modern physics and cosmology. Furthermore, evidence accumulated of what seemed to be deliberate prearrangement of our set of laws and universal constants fine-tuned to support life on our world with almost incredible precision. There's a host of examples of this, which you can read in books. I've put a couple of them up there. Theoretical physicist Paul Davies mentions that if the ratio of the electromagnetic force to the nuclear strong force had been different by one part in 10 to the power 16, no stars could have formed. One part in 10 to the power 16. Now, what's your chance of winning the national lottery, do you think? Maybe one chance in 10 to the 9 or one chance in 10 to the 10, something like that, one in a billion or perhaps one in 10 billion to win the national lottery. Now, this is one chance in 10 to the power 16. So that's six orders of magnitude less chance than winning the national lottery. If the ratio of the electromagnetic force constant to the gravitational force constant were varied by only one part in 10 to the 40, the full range of stars couldn't exist. Almost incredible precision. So that's 30 orders of magnitude less chance than you're winning the national lottery. 30 orders of magnitude. Oxford mathematician John Lennox mentions that the expansion and contraction forces of the universe must be balanced to as little as one part in 10 to the 55. 45 orders of magnitude less than the chance of winning the lottery. Now, Paul Davies and John Lennox and many other physicists have noted dozens of other examples. I've only showed you a small selection here because we've got limited time. But this discovery of all this astonishing fine-tuning triggered questions about where the laws of physics came from in the first place. Why are they just the particular set of laws that we know and not something else? And why are they so amazingly fine-tuned to sustain life and intelligence. Many front-rank scholars and scientists began coming to the conclusion that there must be a designer who'd fixed things up to be the way we see them. A typical reaction is Paul Davies' statement that I think's on there. It seems as though someone has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. Now, the naturalist-atheist rejoinder to this conclusion has usually been to appeal to the idea of multiple universes. Our universe is imagined to be accompanied by an unlimited number of parallel universes. And they're supposed to be continually being born in the different universes. The laws of physics take slightly different forms from the ones we know, and they're fine-tuned in slightly different ways, so all possible outcomes become possible. All possible outcomes. Now, not a huge number of scholars find this conclusion satisfying. Science seeks the simplest rationale that's compatible with facts, whereas this vast multiplication of universes goes completely against this principle. So not only are parallel universes undetectable, but the hypothesis, certainly at the moment, is untestable, and it moves far into the realm of speculation. I'm sure you know that oxymorons are statements that are self-contradictory. Some people like to collect self-contradictory statements. I like to contemplate them sometimes as well. And of course, I try and avoid them in talks like this. Now, there are short, pithy ones like jumbo shrimp or pretty ugly. And then there are sort of ironic ones like negative equity or military intelligence or political science, business ethics. There are long lists of these things. I'd say my all-time favourite is the one of a child who was asked, which is more important, the sun or the moon? And in reply, he said, well, the moon is more important than the sun because the moon gives us light at night when we really need it, whereas the sun only gives us light in the day when we don't really need it. Now, I think you could make a good case for multiple universe being an oxymoron as well. According to one definition, the universe is all there is. So how can you have multiple all there is? Atheist writers are fond of ridiculing religious faith by declaring that belief in God and the supernatural is as rational as belief in fairies. However, I feel that the multiverse hypothesis turns this jibe right back to its origin. Think of this scenario. We have a parallel universe where the physical laws and conditions are only slightly different from our own. Now, let's assume that evolution is capable of all the immense creativity that's claimed for it. So we can imagine that life would develop along somewhat similar lines to our own, and beings somewhat similar to ourselves would eventually evolve, but in my scenario, they would be much smaller, maybe only a foot or a few inches tall in this parallel universe. Now, in our own world, there are flying varieties of birds, fish, reptiles, and mammals, so it's perfectly credible to imagine that these tiny human lookalikes in the parallel universe would develop wings and be able to fly. So there we have it, fairies. If you believe in the parallel universe hypothesis, you're pretty well forced to believe in fairies. Maybe they're in a parallel universe where we can't see them, but you have to believe them. Now, biochemical discoveries had an even more important influence on scientific thinking about origins in the second half of the 20th century. Now, the talk gets a bit scientific about here. If you're not scientifically minded, just hang in there. I'll try and make the conclusions as crystal clear as I can, so just hang in there. Life is known to depend on a large molecule called DNA, and it has a sister molecule called RNA, which is very, very similar to DNA. Now, this molecule stores all the information for making all the proteins and structures in the cells in our bodies. And living things, like our cells, pass on a copy of our DNA, called the genome, to the next generation during reproduction. So all the information that's needed to build our bodies and the bodies of all living things is there, or at least according to one theory it is, it's there in the genome, in the DNA. Now, the amazing double helix structure of the DNA was discovered in the 1950s, and its implications are gradually becoming understood. The crucial feature of this structure is that it resembles a very long string made by coupling together in a particular order many units that are called nucleotides. And the nucleotides are chosen from a basic set of four. Oops, wrong back. Now I've got to find out how this thing. Here is a nucleotide. Look, it's got a phosphate, a sugar, and a base. And there are four different bases. One, two, three, four. There. So the four different nucleotides all have sugar and a phosphate, but they have a different base attached to them. Then the nucleotides link together in a chain. Phosphate, sugar, and the bases are along there. So here's one string and another string. Two strings associate with each other, and then they wrap up into this wonderful double helix that you can see a picture of here or here. So we get this double helix structure. Now, our genes are sections of our DNA, but it's the exact order of the nucleotides in the DNA that determines the information that they carry, and hence the proteins that they can produce within our cells. So the order contains the information, a bit like a computer program. So this order is read off in the cell at the site of protein synthesis, and then our cells generate the proteins that we need for fingernails and hair and red eyes or blue eyes or whatever colour of eyes you happen to have. Now, it soon became apparent that naturalistic attempts to explain the origin of a complex sequence of this kind, loaded with information, faced staggering problems. Consider the time before there were any living things, before there were cells. The neo-Darwinian mechanism of natural selection and random mutations couldn't operate then. So the origin of a particular DNA nucleotide sequence needed for the first living organism would have had to proceed by random chemical assembly. It had to be a pool of nucleotides which came together in the right order to build something meaningful. Statisticians quite quickly showed that the number of possible sequences rises astronomically as the length of the DNA sequence increases. So for just three nucleotide, oops, sorry, I've done the wrong thing again. Oops, now I've got to go back to, there we are. If there were just three nucleotides in the chain, then it's pretty easy to see that there are actually six possible chains that could be built from three nucleotides. If there are four nucleotides in the chain, then you can quite easily see there'd be 24 possible chains that would form in a random assembly process. If there are five in the chain, then there are 120 different DNA chains that could form in a random process. Now, for DNA segments that are of any use in biology, this problem gets completely out of hand very quickly. For example, transfer RNA, that's a short section of RNA, which is used not for storing information, but for carrying little bits of information around in the cell. If there are 77 nucleotides in the chain, then the number of possible chains is 10 to the power 46. If there are 3,000 nucleotides in the chain, as there are in ribosomal RNA, that's where proteins are built in the molecule, then there are 10 to the power 1806 possible DNA chains that could form. Now, any one of those could form in a random assembly, or all of them could form in a random assembly. 30,000 nucleotides is subbacterial DNA. Now, Carcinella ruddi is the smallest living bacterium that's known. So it's one of the smallest living, it is the smallest living cell. It actually has 120,000 nucleotides in its genome, which means that about 10 to the power 66,000 different chains could form in a random process. I think I've got a picture. Yeah, this is Carcinella ruddi here, little bacterium. It isn't actually completely free living. It needs a bit of help from its host, which is this insect called a psyllid, which supplies some of the proteins that it lacks. So the smallest actual free living cell is this bacterium here, Mycoplasma genitalium, and it actually has 580,000 nucleotides in its genome. So the chances of that forming in a random way are correspondingly incredibly small. Now, I wanted you to appreciate just how small these chances are, so I've put a few numbers up here. First of all, I think I had it on a slide there, the number of atoms in the whole universe. I'm talking here the whole universe. That's all the stars, all the galaxies, every single, all the planets, every single thing in the universe. If you add up all the atoms, you get to a number of about 10 to the power 80. If you packed a moderate length DNA sequence, if you packed the whole surface of the Earth 1 meter layer thick with these DNA sequences, you could get about 10 to the power 41 such sequences on a meter layer on the surface of the Earth. If you dissolved them in a 1 millimolar soup in all the oceans, you could get about 10 to the power 42 in the ocean. If you took the total volume of the known universe, the total volume I'm talking about here, not just the volume of the stars, but the total volume, you get to a number of about 10 to the power 120. Now compare that with 10 to the power 1806, for example, or 10 to the power 66,000. You can see that we are multiple orders of magnitude. I mean, gigantically, stupefyingly orders of magnitude away from getting a biologically meaningful sequence just by random assembly. But isn't there enough time? I mean, we've got billions of years. If we were producing these things over billions of years, wouldn't that reduce the numbers to manageable size? Well, if we covered the surface of the Earth by a 1 centimeter thick layer of cells and we let them produce DNA sequences for 10 billion years, they would be able to produce somewhere of about 10 to the power 52 such sequences. You can see, I hope, from the numbers that I'm giving you there, that we're way off. We're way off. It necessarily follows that the chance of a meaningful DNA sequence being obtained spontaneously is almost infinitesimally small. The only reasonable conclusion there is that there isn't enough space, there isn't enough matter, particularly carbon, and there isn't enough time for spontaneous formation of a self-replicating system. I think Robert Shapiro hits the nail quite nicely on the head when he said, and he's a practicing scientist, the improbability involved in generating even one bacterium is so large that it reduces all considerations of time and space to nothingness. Given such odds, the time until the black holes evaporate and the space to the ends of the universe would make no difference at all. We would be waiting for a miracle. Now, scientists still hope that there is some selection mechanism at work in nature which will overcome these enormous odds. Richard Dawkins, for example, published his book Climbing Mount Improbable, and he discusses a computer program which tries to generate the phrase, "Methinks it is like a weasel." So this program has become called the weasel program. Now, it incorporates a selection procedure that's able to beat these impossible odds quite quickly. You'll find this on the web, accompanied by inflammatory statements to the effect that it proves just how ignorant and stupid creationists are. Now, the thing is, to achieve this selection, the computer algorithm compares the phrases as they're generated, or the letters as they're generated, with the target phrase, the DNA structure. So the computer program has to know the DNA structure ahead of time in order to beat these impossible odds. So the target sequence has to be known in the first place, but this is what is supposed to be being discovered. So it's invalid circular reasoning. It assumes what it sets out to prove. Although there's a lot of research into origin of life still going on, not much real progress has been made in the last decades. Science has no viable explanation of how these information-rich biopolymers could have arisen, and there's strong evidence of design in biology. Now, just as the impossible odds facing these origin of life scenarios was beginning to be appreciated, biochemical studies started to reveal the complex nature of structures found in cells, like the bacterial flagellum. Here's a bacterium, and bacteria have this little sort of tail thing that they use for moving around, and it kind of circulates or beats and pushes the bacterium along. Here's a sort of cutaway diagram of the flagellum, and notice that all the parts in it here are special proteins that have been produced by the DNA. There are 20 or 30 specialized proteins that are needed for the bacterial flagellum to work. In the 1990s, biochemist Michael Behe pointed out that for biological machines like this one to work, all or most of the components, they're needed together all at once. Individual component proteins, or small selections of them, have no function. So the Darwinian mechanism can't build the observed complexity by gradual selection of increasingly efficient ones. Just two or three proteins won't drive a flagellum and won't propel a bacterium along. So Behe called these biological machines irreducibly complex. Now, blood clotting is another irreducibly complex structure. If you cut yourself, blood flows, and pretty soon this sort of fibrous material is produced, and it links together the red blood cells in the way that you can see here. A clot starts to form, which hardens over into a sort of crust, and there you are, if everything proceeds normally. Healing process goes in a normal way. Now, this shows a simplified diagram of the enzyme cascade that's found in blood clotting in humans. It's simplified. A very delicate balance has to be kept. For example, if the initial enzyme, the kallikrein here, isn't available at the surface to set the enzyme cascade going, then blood continues to flow. And of course, this is the problem that hemophiliacs face. They're not producing this initial enzymes here, and so the clotting cascade can't go ahead. At the other end of the cascade, we have this thrombin, which activates the fibrinogen and the fibrin. Now, suppose the cascade keeps on and on producing more and more thrombin, then the blood at the surface hardens, and the hardening starts to go into the blood vessel, and further into the blood vessel, a blood clot forms. That can be passed off into your bloodstream and cause you serious health problems. Or, in the extreme, of course, your entire blood system could go solid The whole system could go solid. It's a very delicate balance that has to be maintained here. And nature does this with this cascade, with all these particular proteins. And notice there's a feedback loop here that tells, when there's enough thrombin here, it tells factor 11 here to stop the cascade going, so we don't get a blood clot forming in the system. So blood clotting is another example of a complex biological sequence, another irreducibly complex system. I've got pictures of the... this is the thrombin protein. It's associated with a molecule called hirudin here, but this blue ribbons and red helices is the thrombin, and this is kallikrein that I showed you a moment or two ago. Very complex structures. The ribbons and spirals are complex assemblages of atoms. Now, the neo-Darwinian mechanism holds that mutation coupled with natural selection produces small changes that accumulate over vast periods of time, resulting in large cumulative changes. But irreducibly complex structures like the flagellum and other biological machines require a set of parts, mostly proteins, to be present all at once before they can function. Natural selection can only select functional things. Individual components of biological machines lack function, so they can't be selected prior to the existence of the machine. Irreducibly complex structures can't accumulate in many small steps over any amount of time via mutation and selection. They're powerful evidence of design. Now, analogous mechanical and electronic machines, we're all familiar with machines that are electronic or mechanical, like a computer, for example. They're known to be the products of intelligent minds, taking advantage of natural laws. If you were walking in a forest and came across a computer, you wouldn't say, oh, there's a miracle has happened and this thing has assembled itself by chance. You'd know no natural laws had been violated whatsoever. An intelligent mind, or several intelligent minds for a modern computer, had got together and designed and built the thing. So Professor Behe and Professor William Dembski drew attention to the fact that detecting design is already a well-established activity in scientific fields like forensic science, archaeology, cryptology. You come to a crime scene. The first question you want to know is, was this an accident? Was it just an act of nature? Or was there a criminal mind behind the set of circumstances that we find there? And the forensic science has certain rules, certain procedures that he follows for deciding whether design was involved. Ditto an archaeologist. Same for, you may have heard of the SETI program, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. They're monitoring signals coming from outer space to see if there's an intelligent mind behind them. And they have ways of detecting whether the signal shows design or not. Now, many scientists and scholars were impressed by all this evidence, and the intelligent design movement, the ID movement, came into being with the objective of establishing design as an explanatory tool in nature. I show some of the proponents of the intelligent design movement there. Now, the ID movement has drawn a massive response from secular naturalists, evolutionary scientists, particularly those driven by atheist ideology. And I put a few examples up there. Richard Dawkins published The God Delusion in 2006. Many of you will have heard of that book if you haven't actually read it, I'm sure. Sam Harris publishes Letter to a Christian Nation. The American version of Christopher Hitchens' book is called God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And Daniel Dennett wrote a book called Breaking the Spell. Now, you can see from the titles the bellicose nature of these books. The new atheist authors appear embittered and angry, and they seem pretty intolerant. Richard Dawkins, for example, accuses religion of being the root of all evil, and some of you may have seen the series of two TV programs that he hosted called that. He says that Christians should just shut up. Now, Christopher Hitchens bitterly castigates religion. He says it's incredible, irrational, and harmful. The outrage of the new atheists is very palpable as they contemplate the growing numbers of intelligent thinkers who are coming to the conclusion that God isn't dead after all. In essence, however, their writings just regurgitate standard evolutionary positions laced with some ideology, and they dogmatically insist that evolution is a fact, that the fossil record and the biological science demonstrate evolution, and so on. Everything we've heard from the 1960s. They support the idea that intelligent design has been refuted. And if you search the web, you'll come across many statements to that effect, that ID, intelligent design, has been refuted, and that it's pseudoscience, and that ID scientists are dishonest and ignorant. But in fact, the real issues raised by ID haven't been refuted. They remain intact, and they remain a major challenge to mainstream evolution. Now, in turn, there's been a massive critical response to the new atheists. Many smaller reviews, which I don't have time to talk about, but some book-length assessments, and they include that from biologist-turned-theologian Alistair McGrath, and theologian Thomas Crean, historian John Cornwell, and Presbyterian minister from here in Dundee, David Robertson, and from mathematician John Lennox. Now, you'll have to read them for yourselves, but in my view, these critics have been truly devastating. They pinpoint the lack of scientific objectivity, the wishful thinking, the baseless assertions, and the selective use of evidence, the one-sided reporting displayed in the new atheist literature. I want to give you a flavour of some statements from the new atheist literature. Here's one from Richard Dawkins. I do not believe there is an atheist in the world who would bulldoze Mecca or Chartres, York Minster or Notre Dame. He blandly ignores the officially sanctioned demolition and burning of thousands of churches and mosques by atheist regimes in the former Soviet Union and China. Another statement from Richard Dawkins: there's not the smallest evidence, he says, that atheism influences people to do bad things. In fact, their efforts to enforce atheist ideology of the Soviet authorities, they systematically destroyed churches, executed priests, sent religious dissenters to mental institutions for so-called treatment, much worse than the treatment that I told you about for the man who thought he was dead. Here's another assertion. All faith is blind faith, and Christians consider it a virtue to believe irrational impossibilities. This ignores 20 centuries of a careful theological study, sorting the religiously rational from and believable from the dross. Here's another one from Richard Dawkins. Jesus was a loyal Jew and was hostile to all non-Jews. It was Paul who invented the idea of taking the Jewish God to the Gentiles. And he quotes approvingly this statement of John Hartung: Jesus would have turned over in his grave if he'd known that Paul would be taking his plan to the pigs. What an absurd misrepresentation. Not only did Jesus endorse love your neighbour, but he extended this to love your enemy. And the familiar story of the Good Samaritan makes Christ's positive attitude towards Gentiles crystal clear. It's very apparent that the new atheists major in propaganda and ridicule and coercion. Now, in 2004, Anthony Flew, one of the world's most influential atheists, announced that he'd changed his mind and he now believes that there is a God. This sent shockwaves round the scholarly world, because Anthony Flew has been professor of philosophy at several British and American universities, enormously respected philosopher and campaigner for atheism. It's a very striking portent of just how convincing the new evidence that I've been talking about is. In his book that he published, Anthony Flew insists that he's out to follow the evidence wherever it leads. That's his guiding principle. And he now believes that the universe's intricate laws manifest what scientists have called the mind of God. He cites his realization that natural selection doesn't positively produce anything, that it fails to explain where the immense amount of information contained in genomic DNA came from. That's what I was trying to tell you earlier on. Flew is persuaded that the laws of nature, life with its teleological organization, and the existence of the universe can only be explained in the light of an intelligence that explains both its own existence and that of the world. Flew has joined a growing band of scholars turning to some form of belief in God. Now, although discoveries over the last half century point towards the existence of a transcendent mind, it's still a giant leap to believe that this designer has revealed himself in human history and should be identified with a personal God, the God of Christianity. However, I would say that the climate of opinion in biblical studies has moved back a long way from the extreme skeptical positions that I mentioned at the start. The Newtonian worldview was responsible for destroying belief in miracles, but this has long given way to the quantum worldview, beginning in about 1900 and getting a huge boost in 1926 when Erwin Schrödinger published his famous wave equation. And the quantum world is a very strange world. Particles are supposed to have both the properties, that's quantum mechanical particles like electrons and protons and quarks and gluons, including the particles in our brains, I might mention, can behave as either waves or particles. The laws of physics are known to be statistical in nature, and they only give probability outcomes. And then the Heisenberg uncertainty principle tells us that it's not possible to know both the position and the momentum of a quantum mechanical particle. Effectively, it's telling us that you can't know everything about the universe. There are fundamental limits to what can be known. And entanglement is another strange idea that's come from the quantum world. Now, objects are not independent if they've interacted with each other in some way. Even if they separate to the ends of the universe. And if this all sounds a bit strange to you, and even Einstein called this spooky action at a distance, don't worry, because Richard Feynman, one of the people who contributed most to establishing quantum mechanics, said that I think we can safely assume nobody understands quantum mechanics, and if he didn't understand it, then really nobody does understand it. So there are no certainties in the quantum world. The physical universe can never be described completely. It's a much stranger and more mysterious place than formerly supposed, and the future is open. The vast majority of scientists and scholars now agree science has not proved that miracles can't happen, and indeed is incapable of doing so. Now, I see I've got to end here, so I'm going to skip over a bit, and I'll just come to my last slide or two. Oh yeah, there's my quotation from Richard Feynman. No certainties in the quantum world. Miracles and the supernatural are not forbidden. I put that one up for you, Bob and Moira. Now, here's a few books that have been written recently. As this realization has been seeping into the scholarly world, the reliability of biblical documents is coming to be reassessed. The critical treatment of these documents depended on the secular naturalist assumption that miracles can't happen. They're impossible. But we now know that this isn't grounded in any compelling logic or science. So there's a radical and much more positive reassessment of the reliability and authenticity of the scriptures taking place. And Kenneth Kitchin published on the reliability of the Old Testament. James Charlesworth edited a book about Jesus and archaeology. Richard Borkum from St Andrews University published Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. Paul Eddy and Gregory Boyd published The Jesus Legend, a case for the historical reliability of the synoptic Jesus tradition. And Bishop N. Thomas Wright, the Bishop of Durham, wrote The Resurrection of the Son of God. Now, these are pretty scholarly books, I will admit. They're not always an easy read. Bear in mind Pete Seeger's maxim: education is when you read the fine print. Experience, hard experience, is what you get when you don't read the fine print. So finally, I want to summarise some of the major conclusions. The amazing cosmological fine-tuning suggests the work of a designer in the cosmos. The presence of biological systems of complex, information-loaded molecules like DNA indicates they owe their origin to an intelligent mind. Irreducibly complex biological machines are powerful evidence of design in the living world. These conclusions don't prove that God is still alive, but they show that belief in God is rational and intellectually sound. I think that all who are willing to follow the evidence from nature and from inspiration, wherever it leads, like Anthony Flew, will find that God is alive and he's well and he's full of grace. Thank you very much.